It is Saturday, May 2nd, 2008. 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and a discussion about viruses. Well, during the geek news. During the second half, your questions and comments about technology. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're chatting about geek news. We're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The second half will actually invite you to call in, but you can take the numbers down now if you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now and send us email or post something on our forums. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. But if you'd like to know what's going on right now online and kind of participate digitally with us, you're welcome to join our chat. You can go to geekspeak.org right now, click on today's show, and on the left-hand side, it's called Geek Chat. We'd love to see you in the room. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me right now are geeks Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Good morning.
And Al Luckow, he's a new media architect.
How's it going?
Ben, you switched to mic one.
No, I was on mic one the whole time.
Yeah, I see how it is. Yeah. He's in stereo.
I could pull up the other mic and I can just...
Hey, two mics going into mono. Al and Ben, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Joining me.
Certainly.
Yep. Let's start with Ben. Since you were here last week and Al and I weren't.
I guess that's true. So the scientists have built the world's fastest camera. This thing looks absolutely amazing. So this camera snaps images. It's shutter speed, right? So this is the slices in time that it can capture are less than half a billionth of a second long. So the shutter, yeah.
It's not a physical shutter.
I don't have that kind of.
No, it's not a physical shutter.
Okay,
it's but I mean that's just amazing.
And for people who are
that
really
the shutter
busy,
speed. Oh, go ahead.
If you're really busy and you just don't have much time at all, and so you need a camera that just does a billionth of a second.
Yeah,
you know,
totally
gets
out of your way.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
totally.
You can take 500 pictures and not even notice it.
Right, and that's I have about that much time.
Well, actually, it's funny you should say that. So the shutter speed is 1/2 billionth of a second, or more. Sorry,
it's
less
fast
than that.
Uh-huh.
But the frame rate, this is the rate at which you can capture snapshots. How many snapshots per second can you capture? 6 million
per second.
What?
Images per second.
What? Where do
continuously
they go? How?
Okay, now that's a different problem. Where do you put all this data?
You cannot hold 6 million JPEGs of any size. It's just too big.
Okay, well, first of all, the resolution of this camera is 50 pixels by 50 pixels, right? Now, I mean,
that's
okay,
not much.
I wouldn't recommend this for, like, taking pictures of your children at their birthday party or anything.
Unless
you just don't like
your children, you just want them to be pixelated.
Yeah, people you don't want to see their faces, clearly. But, no, this is for looking at things that happen very, very, very quickly over a very short span of time, and you want a lot of temporal resolution, you could say. We normally use CCDs to do this, and CCDs just can't possibly get up to this frame rate because there's not enough light, right? Because if you're capturing 1/2 billionth of a second,
yeah, the deal with CCDs is the actual cell has to have a lot of photons hit it. So the longer you have it open, the more photons you get, the better picture you get.
So you either need so much light that you'll probably vaporize the thing that you're trying to photograph,
right?
Or do it a different way.
So how are they doing it with this?
Let me see if I can quickly pseudo explain it. Basically, what they're doing is they're shooting. So it's 50 pixels by 50 pixels. It's only 2,500 pixels total, right? Which is very low resolution. And they're shooting this EM radiation at different frequencies in these different pixels, right? This range. So almost like a rainbow.
So each pixel actually is a different wavelength.
It's a different wavelength. And so then they're capturing this. They're putting it through these optical elements. Within which the different wavelengths travel at different speeds,
actually one sensor.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like the way you put white light through a prism.
Wait, I don't think this is a camera. If those 50 by 50 pixels are actually transmitting, that's not a camera. That's a light.
It's recording. It's recording these pictures. I mean, obviously you can't just photograph someone's face. I mean, this is you're getting black and white images out of it, presumably, and everything. But I mean, for medical things for
very fast small imaging,
maybe
it's perfect.
Atomic collisions.
It's okay,
you might be able to get
we're
some
calling it a camera. It's fine. I'm just saying that if you're explaining it correctly, and that each one of these emitters are actually a different frequency, and then you have actually one sensor looking at the thing.
Yeah,
that's a little different than how.
And the way you can get all of this data is the optical elements, which when you put white light through a prism, white light is actually made up of all the different frequencies of visible light, the white light that we see, and so when you put it through a prism, the reason it diffracts like that is because it the red versus the blue, for example, travel at different speeds through the glass, and that changes their direction. That's a pseudo explanation.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it does different speeds. I would say that it changes its reflective index based on its frequency.
Oh,
so
okay.
It interacts with the glass differently.
I suppose I understood that wrong. But in any case, so these optical elements. Yeah, I think it's different speeds, though.
We'll be corrected.
Yeah, definitely. So if anyone knows this for sure, certainly be Googling it.
Well, very cool on the fastest camera.
Yeah, but let me just say, 1 second worth of pixels, 8 bits per pixel, 60 gigabytes.
For a second.
For 1 second. So that means you need to have 60 gigabytes worth of space to put this stuff in 1 second. That's a ridiculous throughput for your data storage method. I mean, how are you? That's a good question.
See, that
just
totally breaks the birthday party thing.
You can't
carry around the kind of storage.
Definitely. I mean, it's, you know, you got high low resolution fast cameras, but this is just ridiculous.
Well, thank you,
yeah,
Mr. Jaffe. So let's talk a little bit about viruses. Al, your first
is
story.
Is it viruses or viri?
Well, viruses.
Something cool happened in the biological world on viruses.
Yeah. I thought since we had all this swine flu virus thing going around.
You know, and for podcast listeners or people that just tuned in, listen to Dr. Don's podcast from today. It's the show that follows us, is before us. And she had a very intelligent doctor response about what's going on with the swine flu.
Yeah, it's at the beginning of her podcast.
We were going to talk
very,
about it more,
good.
But she covered it so well.
We're not actual doctors. We just play doctors on the radio.
Computer doctors.
Yeah, computer doctors. All right. Anyhow, I thought, with all this virus talk, I'd try to think of some virus ideas. And I came across one that's kind of interesting, how a virus could actually end up powering your devices. Now, it's a little bit of a stretch, but let me try to explain this. A team led by Angela Belcher, a material scientist at MIT in Cambridge, has produced a paper, so it's been verified, and this concept can be actually produced, of a way to use viruses to create more efficient batteries. So they've found a virus, and by tweaking the genes of this virus, they could engineer it to work as a sort of a conduit within a lithium battery that extends the battery life. I think I could probably explain this easier if I explain how lithium-ion batteries store energy.
Oh, okay.
They store up and release electrical energy when lithium ions and electrons move between the anode and cathode. Okay, so there's this barrier.
Pretty much all batteries, you've got two different types of materials, and you've got a chemical in there, and they want to they want to attach to one of the sides, and in doing that, they produce an electrical current flow.
Right.
Right.
And the cathode is often made of iron phosphate, mm-hmm. and that reacts with lithium and has a high capacity store energy, but it's not a very good conductor. So the movement of ions and electrons through the cathode is pretty slow, making the battery less efficient for releasing energy.
Oh, interesting.
So what they want to do is create, you know, really thin, a really thin coating of
for the anode.
Yeah. And so what they've done is they've, you would really want to do a nano kind of thing,
level,
but it's just too hard to make nano iron things. It's really hard. So what they've done is they've manipulated the gene of the M13 virus to make the viruses coat themselves in iron phosphate.
Okay.
So they've created very small iron phosphate particles. So basically,
direction viruses.
Right. So they're using a biological template that's already on the nanoscale.
Okay. So what is it? What does that allow the battery to do with the viruses?
It's much more efficient at transferring the energy, and it's much easier to create this very thin conductor. So
okay. So what you're saying is that the virus actually is the migration particle that migrates.
Right. It's coated with this iron particle.
And since it's got iron around it as well, it's going to conduct electricity better after it attaches to the anode.
Right. So they have this virus in these things, and you can create these batteries. They're very efficient. You know,
that's kind of creepy.
It's I don't think you can actually. It would be weird if you were using your computer and you like caught the virus. And well, I mean, it doesn't say anything about like.
It's really interesting, the idea of using a biological agent like that. I mean, you're using life. I mean, virus.
Right.
Most people define a virus.
And the process
is
they mentioned the process to produce this. They have to use water based stuff, and they can't use heat and all this because it can kill everything.
Well, what about the batteries getting hot and killing the virus?
Apparently, it doesn't work that way. Once they've got the thing and they've got the coating, it just sits in there.
So
and
cool.
You've got a virus on your computer that you want.
Speaking about viruses and on computers. And not wanting them actually is what we normally hear about. Let's find out from Alex Slias from our Southern California correspondent joins us now on Geek Speak. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Lyle. How are you doing?
Quite well. Thanks for coming on the phone. You follow the Conficker virus quite a bit, and I just want to get in touch with you and see what's going on. What's the update? What's happening?
Well, not a whole lot's happened lately. For those who haven't, who don't know what Conficker is, it's a virus that's been out there. It's been growing in the number of machines that have been infected, and the different infected machines end up kind of communicating with each other as basically a large botnet that can be used for a range of things, from sending spam to collecting information about the machines that they've infected, like your bank account information, stuff like that, like how you use your computer, et cetera.
And Alex, this is the virus we talked about a month ago. It was supposedly going to do a big update or something on April 1st.
Right. And there was a big update. It was more that some variants were going to be made active on April 1st, and there was a lot of hype about what that means, and people were thinking, it's going to start being used, and you're going to start seeing floods of traffic bringing down servers and stuff, and it really, on April 1st, it really was no big deal. I don't think anybody even noticed much at all. And then later on, a few days, like about a week later, there was a slight update, which it just basically made the bots a little bit more intelligent and harder to beat.
One of the things about this virus is that, first off, is a virus a pretty good metaphor for what this thing is?
Definitely. Okay. It looks for vulnerabilities in a system. I mean, the original method of attack was a vulnerability in Windows known as MS08067, which was basically a vulnerability in the file sharing service for Windows.
Okay, so file sharing was kind of weak, and so this thing actually got into machines through that weakness.
Exactly. And then it found some other methods of spreading around once it's in, and it kind of tries. It would get a little bit smarter about how it did it. But for the most part, it was relying on that particular vulnerability, which still today, that vulnerability was patched back in November, I think.
Uh-huh.
And, still today, there's tons of systems that people just don't patch. And so all those systems are still vulnerable to even the original version of the virus.
Now, I'd always assumed that you were pretty safe if you weren't connected to the internet with a computer because the virus couldn't get to you. But some news about, hospital equipment getting infected happened, even though they weren't connected to the internet. What's going on?
Right. Well, Conficker, one of the additional ways that it used or it spread was to use the the auto run feature in Windows, like when you stick in a USB device or a CD or something like that, it would automatically launch, you know, or can be configured to launch and run a program just automatically on your computer. Usually that's a convenience thing, especially when you're installing some software, you put the CD in and it just starts up for the installation. You know, works great. But, you know, if you put it on a USB device and you plug it into a system, somebody says, hey, there's some pictures on here, and you plug it in and it runs a program, and suddenly that system is now infected. It's a good tactic. There's been, I guess, experiments that people have done where they take a bunch of USB fobs and, you know, put little infections on them that are usually, in the case of, like, tests or experiments, they don't do anything, but they just kind of plug them in and they toss out a bunch of USB fobs and see who plugs them in, who picks them up off the ground outside their office building and goes in the back into their building and says, oh, I wonder what's on this, and plugs it in their computer.
Yeah.
Additionally, you're working at a hospital and you have your fob on you and you want to get some pictures off for the patient, and you don't know that your fob's infected from your home computer.
Exactly. Kind
of so this actually happened, like machines in hospitals got infected.
Yep.
That's kind of scary.
I think at RSA, a big security conference that happens every year. I think they have a couple of each year, but there was one recently, and I think it was the FBI was recently talking about how that happened in the medical environment. Hmm.
So you've become infected by some disease, and you go to the doctor to get analyzed, and turns out the machine that analyzes you is also infected.
Yep,
by a disease.
Pretty much.
So humans and computers are getting closer and closer to...
What, more importantly, how did they come up with the name Conficker?
You know, I have no idea.
That's such a weird kind of name.
Strange.
Well, the real name, I mean, the name that the companies have given it is something else, right? It's like A7492 or something. I mean,
honestly, that's been one of the biggest annoyances for me, and I know some of my colleagues in the security industry is... It's really hard to follow exactly what's going on when you're looking at it at really low-level detail in terms of specific revisions or versions of the virus, because different companies each have their own names. Like McAfee has one, Symantec has another. I mean,
so they talk about the virus under their naming.
Yeah, and what's odd, though, is that they're all kind of working as part of this one group altogether. They're known as the Conficker Working Group. And you'd think that at least they would standardize on some sort of naming conventions for things.
Yeah.
And even still, you get different variations. One calls it version B++. Another one calls it, version C.
That's irritating.
And then they'll be like, oh, this one's actually version, D or version E. It's just really bizarre depending on what the first part of the name is.
Now, and of course, you can't, like, I mean, the metaphors of this are pretty valid. But one of the things that I want to be clear about is a virus is a parasite, right? It damages the host. Is Conficker damaging the host?
Yeah, in some ways. Anybody who's actually infected, one of the things it does is to try and protect itself from being removed from the system that's infected is it modifies the way the DNS works for that local system. Now, DNS is how a computer looks up the host name, such as Microsoft.com, to the IP address, which is how it technically will connect to the system. And it needs to be able to do that lookup in order to connect. Well, it modifies it so you can't actually do lookups. It blocks those lookups for key sites such as McAfee.com or F-Secure or Microsoft.com even.
Is that still a really good way to see if your machine's messed up? If your machine can't get to Microsoft or McAfee,
it's got
infection?
It is, actually. There's if you go to the ConfigureWorkingGroup.org website, they actually have, and I think this was done on a German website originally, or maybe they kind of borrowed it from the Conficker Working Group, but they show a bunch of little images that is actually hosted on the various sites. And you can, depending on if you see all six images, then you're probably clear from Conficker. But if some images are missing, you start to be suspicious about, it blocking your ability to look at those images.
All right. Well, thanks, Alex, for filling us in on what's going on with Conficker. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Not a problem.
Why don't you stay with us in case you have anything to say and join the discussion, okay?
All right.
And actually, who here is a Trekkie to some sense? Alex, are you a Trekkie?
Who here isn't?
Okay, there you go. So we all really are excited about Thursday/Friday of this coming week. Ben, what's going on with the movie?
I'm not going to say anything that's going on with the movie, mainly because I'm trying to avoid references. Like I was talking to you earlier, and you were saying, I don't even want to see the trailer of a new movie that I'm going to see. You know, I don't want to know anything about it. And I kind of have that same feeling. Anything with Star Trek in the name, I just try to avoid right now until I'm going to see it on the 7th at 7.
And you have an extra ticket if anybody wants to go to Oakland with Ben on the 7th.
Yeah, yeah.
Just email
us. I've got an extra ticket.
Especially if you're single and interested in Ben. So...
Well, the other Star Trek news, thank you, Lyle,
sure,
yeah, for the plug. No, the other Star Trek news is over in Pittsburgh at what university? I should have that. Anyway, in Pittsburgh at a university, they're testing this facial recognition software. It's called Pittsburgh Pattern Recognition. It's a startup. Okay, sorry. It's spun out from Carnegie Mellon University. And so it's this facial detection software, and they were you know, trying to refine this process and everything. What a better thing to mine than all of the original series episodes of Star Trek.
So they use that as their basis.
They use that as their basis for setting up all their rules for facial recognition.
Which they
and
just
everything.
Use the crew, they also use the aliens.
Yeah,
they have some crazy faces.
Well, of course they're all, you know, bipeds and. I don't know.
No, I just envisioning one that's just the first Star Trek movie, the face in that is isn't the first one? Oh man, I'm losing myself as a Trekkie. I'm sorry.
Oh no, Lyle, come back.
I'm just imagining large, weird, alien kind of faces.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, in Star Trek, this you see Kirk's face all the time, and Spock's face, and McCoy's face, and then you have all of the other characters, you know, like Scotty and Uhura, and you see him here and there, and Sulu and Chekhov. And what they've done is they've actually been able to automatically map. Here, I'm going to show you the graphic. By episode, all the way from season 1 to season 3, they were able to graph how many appearances their software recognized.
Nice.
And of course, the software isn't perfect, but if Kirk is facing mostly towards the camera, as he mostly is, then it'll recognize him pretty much. If they're far away,
it actually does
a surprisingly good job. I was extremely impressed watching. So they've got YouTube clips. They're in black and white, and there's no sound because of copyright issues, but you can see it draw the little faces around the little boxes around the faces, and the color of the box and the name of the character.
Cool.
And apparently, given the output from all of the analysis, so the computer just says, oh, here's face number one, here's face number two, here's face number three. Oh, this is face number one again, right? It doesn't know the names of these characters, obviously.
Right.
Computers aren't that good yet, and so apparently it took less than 5 minutes to assign the names for the entire series of all of the output from this program.
Wow.
You know, just say, oh yeah, person one, that's Spock. Person two is Kirk. Person three is McCoy.
How long it takes to process all the video, though?
Oh, I have no idea. Probably forever. But
it's a neat thing, you know. But when you consider, though, that all the people in this show are always looking exactly the same. Like, I mean, if you see me when I wake up in the morning, I don't look like I look right now.
Right.
You know,
in fact, they all have makeup to make them
animal.
Look like they don't look.
And they're like wearing the same clothes. They have the same makeup. Their eyebrows are exactly the same.
Right.
Their haircut. Then nothing changes.
Right. They don't change their facial hair.
So.
I got the impression that they were using more eyes, nose, mouth, cheekbones than hair, just based on where the lines
were. Pretty much have to do that with facial recognition.
But I mean, you know, if you think about the implications of this, you know, like they have on this website, they've clickable navigation to different scenes with different characters. You can search for specific people. I just pulled up a graph just right now on my computer, and you can go to geekspeak.org. I've posted up the link where you can get a graph of all of the characters, how many times they appear over the entire series from season 1 all the way through the end of season 3. You can embed hyperlinks about, you know, characters. You maybe even bring up bio where you click on a character and it shows information about them. And then using this in different contexts, it's just the
great.
Possibilities are endless.
Finally, a not creepy way to use facial recognition. Thank you, Ben, very much.
Yes.
Yeah. Listen to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow, and over the phone in Southern California, Alex Lias. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arlo, streaming live and podcasting at kusp.org. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5800. 877. Let's go, Al. Let's go ahead and grab another one of your news stories. Let me see which one is that I really wanted. Oh, yeah, Little Snitch. We chatted about this earlier in the week through email and stuff. So, yeah.
Well, in my continued theme of viruses, virals, one of the dangerous things about viruses is that they attempt to take over your computer. But take that one level further, where instead of just a program doing malicious things, say a human is on the other end. So, like what's happening with the Conflicker virus. That's a whole new...
Noel.
Yeah.
That's a whole... like your name. There's no... No, sorry.
Yes, right. that's a new can of worms here. So, what can you do about it? Now, I'm primarily Mac-based, so I don't generally put virus programs on my machine. I mean, you know, all the viruses that you're reading about, you know, really are kind of Windows-based.
Right.
And so, I'm not saying there aren't viruses on the Mac, but... I've never had one.
They're proof of concept, not on the world, mostly.
I mean, I've been using a Mac since they came out, and I've never got one. So, you know, be that what it, you know. The one thing that I do, though, is I use this program called Little Snitch. And what Little Snitch does is it's sort of the opposite of what a virus program seems to be doing. Viruses programs say, oh, something's trying to come in and do this. Little Snitch watches everything going out. So it's a very simple approach. Anything that wants to... phone home. So you might have something on your computer.
Applications do it all the time. That's how like Adobe does the auto updates, right? Is it runs every once in a while, it goes and checks Adobe and says, hey, this is the version I've got nothing new, and it tells you. So it's a useful thing for some applications to be able to do this.
Sure. A lot of times you want this to happen. But Little Snitch, like for example, if you open an Adobe program, it's going to say, hey, Adobe's trying to phone home. And you might say, okay, you know, click the okay button or remember forever is okay, you know, or, you know, all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And you're able to create like a whitelist of things. But then every now and then something pops up that like, why is this program on my machine? Why is it phoning home? You know, a lot of this stuff, there could be a lot of reasons. Could be a virus.
Right.
Could be just a really poorly written program that's just doing things that you don't want.
A lot of these freeware applications, you know, they give you a free application. They want to make money on it. There's other ways to do it. So it's not exactly a virus in that you installed it. It's not going to spread by itself. Mm-hmm. You chose to install it, but it might be doing something you don't actually like. And so this gives you a clarity on what it's doing is basically what this app does.
And it's nice to know that stuff. Even though, you know, you can also optimize your machine. You know, you don't want your machine constantly calling.
And,
you know,
especially if you've got a slow network.
Right. You had mentioned something about, you know, you don't want Apple checking for updates all the time. You know, you want to be able to know when it's doing it. I don't want it to do it right now. You know, all that kind of stuff. That's what Little Snitch, and it's been around for years. I mean, I've used this thing for, I don't know, probably close to 10 years.
We don't like to talk about prices on
this cheapo program.
It's,
I mean,
it's not that expensive. Cool. Thanks.
And
that links up our site.
Speaking of impressive programs, and speaking of things getting out of your network or things sending out data from your network that you don't necessarily know about, I've found this actual freeware program called Menu Meters, which I install on every single computer I come across, if I can convince the owner to let me. And it shows you your CPU usage and your network usage and your hard drive access. And it's up in your menu bar. This is a Mac program, unfortunately, no version for Windows, as far as I know. But it's kind of nice because, you know, I'll be working on my computer and I'll suddenly notice that there's all this outbound traffic, and it'll kind of freak me out. I'll wonder what's going on, what is sending all that traffic, or why am I getting suddenly a spike of inbound traffic. It's kind of a way of just keeping just understanding what's happening with your computer, as opposed to not, you know, as we all are by default. We're kind of blind working on these computers. There are all these ways in and out of these computers, you know. Or suddenly your computer starts running slow and you look up, and if you have this installed, you can notice, oh, my CPU is tacked at 100%. What's doing that? Then you can open up Activity Monitor and see what process is doing that, and then close whatever application that is.
And what is it that you're using, Ben?
It's called Menu Meters. I'll post a link on the show page.
I've seen it too. That's a great one.
It's just a wonderful application. I love
it. Well, let's start taking some calls. We've got some people waiting for us, and let's go ahead and go with we'll go ahead and go with Karen. Now, Alex, you're going to kind of hear her at the same time, so I might lose you, Alex, and just stay with us, see if this works out. Hi, Karen. Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hi, Karen. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks so much.
Where are you calling from? What area?
I'm from Capitola.
Capitola, great. What's your question today?
All right, well, it's about viruses since you're on the subject. I have the Bloodhound virus, and I was wondering, it was caught in my quarantine. It's in quarantine now from my Symantec, and I'm wondering, but my computer runs really a lot slower than it used to, so I don't know. There might be some inherent damage or something that's going on there. Is there anything I can do? What's the best thing to, I don't know, see if there's another virus or get my computer to run faster, or what's the next step, you think?
You said you're using, whose application are you using for virus protection? Norton?
Semantic.
Semantic? Yeah. Yeah, make sure you have the most recent version of Semantic and run that and make sure you're updating your Semantic profile, if you will, the instructions that come down from Semantic. Alex, do you have any other suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, it's running, making sure you have the latest updates for your antivirus is important. A lot of people will install it and, you know, then it'll say, oh, I want to do updates, and then they say, oh, not now, or something like that, or end up turning it off. So make sure that you got the latest updates for it. Usually there's a really obvious button that says update now, and then run a full scan in your system. That'll at least be able to check to make sure that you have all the latest or all the current ways to be able to detect whatever it is you might have. You know you've run that. And then, again, keep checking.
Alex, how do you know if the virus that you're infected with isn't smarter than your antivirus protection? Aren't some of them modifying antivirus, or pretty much you're okay if you've got an antivirus application on there?
Yeah, you really don't. I mean, there are some viruses that are really smart and they update faster than the virus companies are able to.
Do you know about Bloodhound, which is what Karen has?
I'm not familiar with that. I was just Googling it. I don't know too much of the details about how it is, what it does, or, you know.
Apparently you can remove Bloodhound. There's a method for removing it. I actually posted the link. We'll have it on geekspeak.org. But there's a pretty well-defined method for removing Bloodhound.
Oh, okay. Because I tried with my antivirus checker. It says, would you like to try to repair this? And I say yes, and then it says, oh. Sorry, this is one we can't repair, but it's stuck in quarantine, so I guess I have to use another program.
So the quarantine thing, basically, if it's in quarantine, it's not actively functioning on your machine. But here's the geek answer in some sense about what happens when you have a machine that's infected. I normally reinstall the Windows operating system. I wipe the system, get the data off, and reinstall. And the reason for that is a twofold thing. One is you're kind of in this place where you hope that everything's okay, but since you're infected once, it's possible you're infected by more things. You're not really sure. And the second thing is that Windows does a lot better when you start over again. And that's just one of those things that a lot of geeks will do with their Windows systems is they'll reinstall every 6 months or
a year. A lot of cobwebs in there gumming things up after just a certain amount of time just having it on, not even using it. I have a PC that I barely use. I use it for testing. I do a lot of design work and it has to show up on the PC. I don't use email on it. I don't buy things on it. I don't do anything. But yet this thing is full of spyware. And
you know, unfortunately, you know. Unfortunately, right now, all the geeks that are in here, they're primary users of Macintoshes. And so we're not as strong as we once were on the show about Windows and how to make it faster. But pretty much the Windows geeks that I interact with, and when my own machines get slow, I do a reinstall of Windows. Now, there'll be a lot of people out that are talking, that are thinking, no, don't reinstall. You don't have to do that. You just clean it up. But the process isn't that difficult. Any case, that's kind of my recommendation. At the same time, it's not a fun process to go through. It's going to take a night.
Okay, just quickly on that. For reinstalling Windows, do I have to delete the current version and then install it, or will it delete the current version when it's reinstalling it?
Well, let's hear what Alex has to say, because I think he has some criticism. Alex, what do you think? My response.
That is a good approach. In dealing with Windows, I'm actually kind of tempted to do something similar for my mom's, and she has symptoms that are making me think that there's something on her system. But one thing I was going to say, you can also run other versions of antivirus software that might help to just try and download a free one and run with that scan, because sometimes the different vendors have different ways of identifying a virus. But also, I was just reading on this page that I found about Bloodhound and information about it and how to remove it, is that it was a vulnerability in Internet Explorer and Outlook Express. From February of 2004. I'm not sure exactly when Microsoft patched it, but I'm guessing it wasn't too much after that. So make sure your Windows is up to date as well. Make sure your system has all the latest patches and latest updates from Microsoft and really any other software you have. If you have Adobe Reader, you want to make sure that you get the updates from that regularly, especially Adobe's got some recent issues that you want
Karen,
to treat.
Karen, I want to continue on with the other calls, but let me just ask quick, what version of operating system do you have?
XP Pro.
Okay. So to answer your question in a short sense of what you have to do to reinstall it, when you've got an infected machine, I don't do an upgrade path, right? So you actually wipe the current version and install a new version. The way that I normally do that is by getting a new hard drive, taking the old hard drive and moving it as a secondary, and then the new hard drive installing Windows Fresh on it, and then slowly moving the data files over from the old hard drive to the new and not running any applications on the old hard drive. All that process, though, it's quite a process, of course, and it's an expense and time.
Okay.
But that's how geeks normally do it. Karen, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, let's go ahead and go to SoCal. Greg, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, this is Greg in SoCal.
Uh-huh.
I got a standalone Wi-Fi radio receiver, and I'm having issues with buffering. I'm using an Wi-Fi router in my business versus Ethernet cable. And is that caused by the radio station or bandwidth or just my Wi-Fi system?
When you say Wi-Fi radio, are you talking about like you're using a laptop, you're using Wi-Fi?
No, I have just bought a separate little receiver that's a Wi-Fi radio.
What's the name of it?
C. Crane Company.
So you have an Internet radio that's
Internet radio,
Wi-Fi.
Yeah. It's Wi-Fi, yeah.
And it's having trouble buffering.
It is. It's buffering. And this, what's the concept of buffering? Is that always going to happen?
It doesn't play until it's got enough.
Then it gets going, and then it stops.
Yeah, basically, if the general idea is let's say you're filling up a glass of water and drinking at the same time, and there's a really small amount of water coming out of the faucet, right? So you can fill the cup about halfway, and then you're sick of waiting, and you drink it, and then you got to put it back under there and wait again until it's halfway full and drink it again. That's what the buffering is. It's that the stream is not coming in fast enough for you to actually drink. So no matter what you do, when you're in a situation where it's too slow, it's going to buffer, play it, and it's not going to work. The reason why we use the term buffer is that if you have a connection that is actually fast enough to stream at a real rate, it's fast enough and it's thick enough, but there's some inconsistencies, right? Someone's stepping on the hose in the garden, and every once in a while it kind of dips. So then you have a trickle flow. You start it up. You fill the cup. It's coming out fast enough to drink from, but you've got a little bit of filler in case the dog steps on the hose at that time. So it's just for the little inconsistencies, and that's what buffering is actually for, is to fill in the gaps for the inconsistencies. It only really works if you actually have a connection speed that's bigger than your streaming need. And it sounds like you don't. And I would assume that the Wi-Fi radio, whatever that actually means, it seems a little strange of a term.
Well, it's not strange to me.
Oh, well, go ahead. Al knows what it is.
I was founding employees of Curbango, which was the first standalone internet radio.
That's what I got.
Came around in 2000.
Oh, wait, you have a Curbango?
You couldn't possibly have a Curbango.
What name says yet?
No, I have a standalone.
He's got a standalone internet radio, yeah, which I think are fantastic ideas. I mean, basically, you have a radio that can play 10,000 radio stations. I mean, we had in Curbango, we could play 10,000. This was in the year 2000, you know. But the things that you're describing nowadays, a lot of these things, there's another internet radio called Roku, and there's a couple of them that are coming out now, only 9 years after Curbango did it, I might add. But anyhow, there's a couple coming out now, and they really do play pretty well. I've heard quite a few of them. So it's usually, have you noticed that the buffering problem is on a specific station?
I switched around this morning, and it was like on all the stations, but when I ran it Thursday, it ran great all day.
So maybe is there a problem with the distance between your Wi-Fi hotspot and where your radio is?
That could be it. I could move it to a closer, so maybe that.
Yeah. Here are some things that will actually interfere with Wi-Fi. Home portable phones, wireless phones in your home.
Right.
Some of those frequencies are bad, and then also microwaves. And it depends on the radio frequency of your Wi-Fi, which will cause interference. And then the structure members in your house, there's a lot of things that actually can cause interference. So I think moving it around, does it have a signal indicator?
No, I haven't. I just got it like Thursday, so I haven't noticed that.
Sometimes they have like a little bar or something on it to tell you how much connection it has.
Okay.
And it's actually kind of important to use. But in a cheap metering bar thing like that is actually not very good at telling you the real signal strength. So you might get 100% signal strength, but it's actually getting a lot of multipath, which is it doesn't matter. In any case, so because the meter's not necessarily that good, it's just kind of showing the peaks, but it's not really showing the clarity. In any case, so I'd move that radio around until it started working. What you could do is just take it and move it about 5 feet from your Wi-Fi station.
Okay.
About that far away in a clear line of sight. Don't put it right next to it, because that's going to be hard for it, too.
Maybe if I hardwired it, that would help.
If you hardwired it, it would probably do it. But in any case, if you try the 10-feet thing, or you hardwire it, and it still has a problem, I'd talk to the company that sold it to you.
Okay. What about, would a solar system interrupt the solar electricity? Would that?
No, probably not. Your DC to AC converter that's actually probably at your meter or maybe right. with the panels does have a lot of RF signaling. It's actually is it really heavy, the transformer?
No.
So it's not. So since it's not really heavy, that means to me that it's not actually an inductive coil. It means that it's actually like a electronic switching device, which will produce a lot of noise. You could try to just turn it off during the time when you're testing and see if it affects it.
Or do it at night.
Yeah, or at night.
Does the internet radio have the option of hooking up to Ethernet?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, you could also just do that, and if it runs fine then you know it's specifically a Wi-Fi problem.
Great.
Right, and if it doesn't run fine, it's either the radio or it's your internet connection provider, and that's, of course, a possibility.
Yeah. Well,
thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, and Alex Lias are on the in the air room and on the phone with me. We're taking calls with questions and comments of technology. You can ask us things if you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're now going to Santa Cruz. Barb, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, good morning. Well, I'm not a geek. Simple question. I made my first iMovie, and I went to put it on YouTube, and because I had put some songs I had picked up off my iTunes on it, it's copyright, it came out silent.
Yes, mm-hmm. Isn't that fun?
I was wondering how they figured out. Do they have software that picks that up?
Yeah, they sure do. They do an audio fingerprint on some copyrighted material, and then they compare that audio fingerprint to to the submitted video.
It's happened to all of us.
And actually, someone actually did a whole bunch of research into just like trying different things and trying to figure out how this worked. Just kind of looking at it backwards, and found that if you use, I'm not condoning, you know, breaking copyright law, but currently YouTube's algorithm, apparently if you use after the 30-second mark in the music, you won't
it
get
won't
detected.
Be detected.
Yeah.
So the thing is,
strangely enough,
there's another way that can happen too. Someone can watch your video and then submit it and say this is copyrighted issue.
Yeah, they can flag it.
I personally have a lot of mixed feelings about copyright. I don't like how corporations are involved so much in art making, and I'm not sure how much these large corporations are actually helping art making. But coming down to like the point, there's a couple ways to look at copyright. One is that if you don't use somebody else's copyright, you're actually kind of supporting new works being made, right? So if you go, well, it's going to cost money to use that copyright, or it's impossible to do so, to use that music that I want to use, I'm going to have to find other music. You're kind of supporting other and newer music. So you can kind of think of it as a beneficial thing. Try to find something you like that you can use. And one way to do that is to find like a local band that's come through town, whatever. Lots of times they're not under a label, and you can buy your CD and ask them if they
use public domain music too.
Tons
I use
of public
tons
domain.
Of that. I mean,
yeah.
The other thing to think about though is, especially if you're using a Mac, is the reason that you're getting caught with this is because YouTube is this public forum. You've got MobileMe. You can post your own videos with whatever you want on your own personal accounts that then you could then share with relatives via URL, which is probably.
And then it doesn't matter if it's got corporate stuff.
I mean,
really.
If you're making your own iMovie things, sometimes you just want to take pictures of people and do, the party and put some music behind it.
That seems
totally valid to me.
Yeah.
Ben, you know a lot about sharing video. There's other sites that do it.
If
you use Vimeo?
Facebook? No, Vimeo has a pretty strict policy. They don't do a whole audio fingerprinting thing, but...
But they say very clearly don't cover it. But you can make a public video. I mean, you can make a private video, right?
You can make a private video, so, but, I mean, with Vimeo, if you get caught, they'll just shut down your account. That's what they threaten, what they say they can do. They reserve the right to do that. So, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of a touchy subject because the companies want to do enough that they can't be caught for hosting copyrighted material,
the reason Google is doing the search on the YouTube videos that are being submitted is because they can, and if they are posting a lot of copyright material and somebody sues them and says, look, you could have done this, you're liable. That's kind of the reasoning why they're doing it.
And 5 years ago, that was a big problem. Everyone was worried that YouTube was going to shut down. A lot of people were thinking, why did Google buy YouTube? Because YouTube has all of this
problems.
It's one gigantic copyright violation.
It is.
And so Google at least has to make present the appearance of caring about it and doing something about it. Whether or not they actually do, that's actually irrelevant. They just have to legally present the show that they're trying to do something about it.
Right. Well, so, I hope that we helped you, Barb.
Well, I have noticed since I was silenced that I've seen others where, hey, that's a copyrighted song, but it does come in, and I think it's what you're talking about.
Well, sometimes it passes the audio fingerprint, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, audio fingerprinting is kind of an interesting, tricky business. You know, it's kind of hard to do technically.
I'd support the idea of not putting someone else's song on YouTube. Just because there's this, I mean, even though the system's really messed up, there's a big part of this idea that if the system's messed up like that, don't use those people's music, right? They should, you're kind of... It's not so much that you're using someone's music without without permission, but it's you're promoting that music without permission. So you're doing something that's actually promoting their music. Don't promote their music. I mean, that's kind of my take on it. I know that you probably want to use the song that you want to use. Another way to do it is just, you know, have a whole bunch of, if it's like a kid's thing, have the kids sing the song and then put that. It's always fun to have kids singing on videos, but I don't know what the video is. But Barb, thank you so much for the call.
And it's interesting. Okay. That's actually a good incentive to support indie music.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of saying. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, is that not only are you promoting their music by putting it in your videos, you also start listening to more of that music.
Right.
So, yeah.
If you can find like a band that's come through your neighborhood, somebody or friends or whatever, and start using their music for anything you do, if you get their permission, you're doing something that's totally different than using the popular music. You're engaging in a new art form, and you're supporting someone that's doing new work.
I wonder what it would be if you just got permission. Like if you're doing like a thing for your kids and you use some, you know, Proud Mary or something, some song,
right,
and you were able to get the asking, I want to pay the ASCAP fee. I mean, I want to pay it. I like this song.
It's kind of expensive for personal.
I don't know. I deal with these rights a lot.
Sometimes they're not that expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with distribution. I mean, is it like for commercial purposes or whatever?
But of course, the big thing is you could get permission from an industry. Google will still not, YouTube will still not let you do it.
Right.
Yeah, like, that's true.
Even if you've gotten a permission, it's going to be a pain to get that to
work. That is true. So that's definitely a hole with the system.
Yeah, definitely.
There are also a lot of free sites out there where you can find content that other internet users have created and uploaded for free. Kind of like on Flickr, you can find Creative Commons or those kinds of images within the advanced search. You can find a lot of music that way.
We're going to go to Marina right now and talk to Banran. Is that how you pronounce your name, Banran?
Yes.
Hi. This is probably the last call for today. I'm not sure, but certain. But anyway, Banran, what's your question?
I'll try to make it quick. This is a Mac question. I had Mac 10.3. I think that was Panther. And I've configured my Mac for a wireless connection. I installed the Air card, and it worked wonderfully. When I upgraded to 10.4, I think that's Tiger, or maybe I've got them backwards.
10.4?
Yes.
Is Tiger, yeah.
Okay. Now I have to put in the name of my network and my password every time. It seems to forget the values that I put in every time I reboot. It's kind of an annoyance. Is there something I'm not doing right?
Occasionally that'll pop up. There's no checkbox that says save this key.
No,
there isn't.
I've looked.
For what application?
This is just to connect for the internet.
For the wireless, for airport.
For airport.
Yeah, I have to go back and create other network every time, put in name of the network and the password.
I think it's a preference file issue.
Well, okay, so here's basically the way it works. You've got this utility. It's in your applications folder on your hard drive, applications, utilities, keychain access. And that program manages all of, they're called keychains. They're, hold on a sec.
Right, I mean, I'm looking in Leopard, and I just went into Advanced Preferences.
It'll remember the network, but it's not going to remember the password. That's the problem.
Can I text something else right now? Do you have a password on your Mac? When you log in your Mac? Okay, sorry, go on.
That could have been a problem. But anyway, one thing you can do is you can open up Keychain Access, and you can look for the entry that represents your wireless network. If there is one, then apparently it's not working, or it's got it saved wrong or something. And so what you can do is you can delete that entry in the keychain utility.
Yes.
And then you might be prompted for a password, and it might actually save it correctly that time.
Yeah, I think that's a good
idea. And then the other way to do it, this is very drastic, but you could delete your keychains, your entire keychains file, but that's kind of... that's kind of playing with fire a little bit. You know, maybe it's
Alex, do you know a little bit about keychains on the Mac?
I haven't really looked into them, so yeah. No, not really.
Yeah. I've seen this kind of problem exist before, by the way, and I really think it has to do with the file that I'd almost do a fix permissions would be another thing.
That's a very good
under,
thing to do.
Under utilities, there's an application called
Disk Utility.
And fix permissions is one of the things you can do on the entire hard drive.
Yeah.
It's possible you can't actually modify the entry that actually links to that name of the wireless. Is this wireless point your wireless point?
Yes.
Another thing to do is change the name of the wireless point. I know that seems like a really silly thing to do, but if you log in your wireless point and actually change the name to something else...
Well, I'm not broadcasting the name. I've heard that that's probably a good security not to broadcast the name.
Oh, that's why you can't save it. Ben, that's what's going on.
Hmm.
He doesn't have broadcast ID happening. So it doesn't auto-select it, so you've got to select it manually. It says you have to select it manually. It's not keeping the keychain. I would go ahead and broadcast it. Turn on WAP protection and broadcast the name, and this problem will probably go away. You actually already have WAP protection on. That's why you've got to enter password in the first place.
It's in the airport.
Yeah.
Preferences.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call.
Yes.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, let's see. It's the end of the show, unfortunately. We got one more thing coming up I want to recommend to you. I'm going to pass the thing off to you, Al, about USB in just a second.
Oh.
So, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. You're listening to Geek Speak, and Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, is used with permission. I want to mention really quick, we were talking about offering another Windows solution to virus checking. The one that we recommend seem to all the time on the show is FreeAVG. That's free.avg.com. It will be on the GeekSpeak website for today's show. And Al, you got 80 seconds.
Here's the wacky idea of a USB drive. I was talking to a friend of mine, Ginny, this weekend, and I found that she has really a need for a lot of USBs, a lot of USB ports. Here's a USB port. It's called a tape. It's a tape dispenser doubling as a four-port USB hub.
So basically, Scotch tape?
It's a Scotch tape dispenser, and on the bottom of it, you've got four ports. It's sort of my wacky USB form factor.
And if you need one of those USB form factors or any information about anything we covered on the show today, please feel free to join us online, geekspeak.org. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Car Talk.